Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Muslim Brotherhood said last week they were willing to die for their cause. A week later, they have proved it. More than 1,000 supporters of deposed Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi dead. The Egyptian military back in charge and cracking down. The United States looking out of it. And huge questions on the table about the country's and the region's future. This hour on Point, the crisis in Egypt. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is this a bloody stumble forward, a stumble back, another Syria in the making? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We will hear later in this hour from Jackson Deal of the Washington Post editorial page and a tough critic of President Obama's reaction to Egypt's crisis. But first to Egypt. Joining us now from Cairo is Mona Etelhawi, Egyptian columnist who rose to international prominence in the 2011 Tahrir Square outpouring. She calls the situation in Egypt a necessary mess. Mona, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being with us from Cairo.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
Also with us from Doha is Shadi Hamid, also Egyptian, director of research for the Brookings Doha Center. Shadi Hamid, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you both here. Mona, you're in Cairo. At this hour, who's still in jail? We've been hearing about the Hosni Mubarak, former, you know, iron ruler, maybe to be let out. What's the status of that, Mona?
Well, I mean, yesterday I know a lot of people were very upset, including myself, obviously, to hear that there was a likelihood that he could be released. But I'd like to put a caveat to that, and it seemed to be his lawyer, Farid Deeb, who initiated this idea. And his lawyer in the past has pronounced Hosni Mubarak on the verge of death many times and miraculously brought him back. But judicial sources have told several news agencies that Mubarak remains in jail and awaits new charges that have been passed that he now faces. But I think the point about the Mubarak trial all along, and this is something Egypt still suffers from, is that we don't have a free and independent judiciary, and we don't have security services who can provide the kind of evidence that a true trial of Mubarak and his cronies needed. And so when you saw Mubarak acquitted, outrageously acquitted, you have to remember that that judiciary is largely one that he appointed. And then when Mohamed Morsi from the Muslim Brotherhood, who was overthrown a few weeks ago, when he was president for a year, in November of 2012, he assumed tremendous power to himself, ostensibly to fix this judiciary so that people like Mubarak and his cronies could face fair trials for what they did to the revolution. So we've seen none of this happen. And we have years of this, and this is a huge problem that will continue to plague us. And I think this is what the Mubarak saga yesterday reminds us of.
Shadi Hamid, we now see lots of Mubarak people back in power, above all General Sisi, defense minister, your figurehead president there, Adli Mansour, the interior minister, the foreign minister, the finance minister. Is this Mubarak too, whether he's still in imprisoned or not, Shadi? Is the old regime back?
Yeah, sure, Tom. I should just note first, though, that I'm an American of Egyptian origin.
Yes, sir,
I can't
of
really
course.
Speak
yes.
as an Egyptian like others. But you're right to point out to this problem of Mubarak 2.0. But what I fear is that we're not just seeing a return to the Mubarak regime. We're seeing a return to something even worse. I mean, what we saw last Wednesday was the highest single-day death toll in Egypt's modern history. Egypt never saw a massacre like that under the Mubarak regime, and for that matter, not even under the much worse Nasser regime in the 1950s and 60s. So we're seeing the use of overwhelming, indiscriminate force like nothing that any of us are familiar with. So that's obviously a very troubling sign, to say the very least. And I don't think we can even speak anymore of a democratic transition in Egypt. We got to put that vocabulary out to the side. There is no democratic transition in Egypt. What we're seeing is the restoration of the old order, but I would actually posit that it's even more dangerous than the old order because it has the backing of millions of ordinary Egyptians who are actually cheering the army on to be even more brutal than they already are with their political opponents. So we're seeing this genuinely scary kind of neo-fascism, this army worship, this adoration of the general leader. And that's what makes, I think, this situation so difficult to address. It's not just about a small elite at the top. It's about a mass movement that wants this.
Neo-fascist and millions cheering it on. We'll come back to that. Mona, how do you interpret what we've seen in the last week or two, starting with that terrible bloodshed last Wednesday, 600 plus in a single day, and then big picture, what's going on? You've called it a necessary mess. Shadi Hadid sees it as something. Shadi Hamid sees it as something quite different.
Well, first of all, Tom, I'd like to unequivocally condemn the mass killings by the security forces in Egypt. They're absolutely unjustifiable. I did not think that it was that they should have broken up the sit-ins. I think they should have left them as they were. And by breaking the sit-ins, what they ended up doing was precipitating the single worst incident of mass killing in modern Egyptian history, and also terrible reprisal attacks. And Human Rights Watch have documented, after the breaking or the breakup of the sit-ins began, attacks by Muslim Brotherhood protesters on churches. This is documented by Human Rights Watch now, this is not me, on churches across the country and on police stations also and other institutions. Now, all of this violence must be condemned. Whether the violence comes from the regime and the military that backs it, or whether that violence comes from Muslim Brotherhood supporters.
Yep.
And to add to Shadi's things about neo-fascism, I consider these two sides, these binaries, because for decades now we've been pushed into choosing, into essentially making a false choice between a military-backed regime and between the Muslim Brotherhood. These binaries are not friendly to Egypt, and we've seen the outcome of having to choose between them for the past six decades. I consider both sides fascist. I consider the Muslim Brotherhood, and we've seen plenty of incitement from its leaders, and as I said, documented violence by Human Rights Watch, documented violence.
Yes.
I consider fascists with gods and guns on their side, and I consider General Sisi and the regime that he backs also fascist for the horrendous acts of violence that they commit. Now, I know that there are other Egyptians like myself who refuse to continue to make this choice between the regime and its military and between the Muslim Brotherhood. We need a way out of this. And the reason I call this a necessary mess is because I think we're seeing the latest episode of this binary playing out. And the Egyptians are watching it horrifically on their streets and on their screens. And they're thinking, how does this false choice help Egypt? And clearly it doesn't. So I think that the first step we need to do is recognize that we can't continue to make this choice and we must condemn it and say, I refuse. And now come up with alternatives that help take us out. I have not given up on Egypt. I remain tenaciously optimistic, and we have to move ahead.
But Mona, we thought that Tahrir Square in 2011 was the breakout moment when the secular pro-democracy Egyptians stood up and said, we don't want this binary choice. We want something else, and we will have it. We thought that was the path. What happened?
I think it's one of many breakout moments, Tom, and I think that the revolution that began on January the 25th wasn't just secular Egyptians. It also included the Muslim Brotherhood.
Of course.
That's why so many of us are so disappointed by what the Muslim Brotherhood did when their man, Mohamed Morsi, became president. Even though he was democratically elected, we recognized in what he did, he became an authoritarian, and we realized that we can't fetishize the ballot box because democracy and this breaking point has to take us beyond saying democracy equals a piece of paper in a ballot box. Democracy needs institutions. Democracy needs everybody's right and voice to be recognized. Democracy needs the rehabilitation and holding accountable and using ideas of justice with the security forces, with the judiciary, with the military itself, none of which Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood have agreed to. Well, Mohamed Morsi, ironically enough, when he rushed through this constitution for Egypt, strengthened only two institutions in Egypt, and that was the Muslim Brotherhood and the military. That's why I say it's ironic. And that's why I don't consider this breakout point in Tahrir the beginning and the end. I think it's one of a series of processes. It's not even 3 years yet. What country on earth makes a revolution work 3 years later when it's fighting decades of entrenchment by both the regime and the military and the Muslim Brotherhood?
Shadi, you say there's no democratic transition here, maybe not at the moment, but was there an alternative, realistically, to some kind of bloodshed here? You had a deeply entrenched deep state military at the heart of it. Were they ever going to give that up without a tough fight, including blood?
Well, the alternative was not having a military coup. And many of us warned against the consequences of that course of action early on. The history of military coups is very clear. Military coups are bad for democracy. It's remarkable we even have to point that out.
Yeah.
But naturally, a military coup displaces, in this case, an elected leader, a democratically elected leader. And obviously, those who have been pushed out of the political process, what do you do about them? You have a crisis of legitimacy where you have one part of Egypt that sees Mohamed Morsi as their president and the other that sees the interim president, Adli Mansour, and the army as their leaders. So the problem here is, how do you resolve that crisis of legitimacy? So I think the original sin, so to speak, was the coup. And once that happened, it became very difficult to undo the damage. There was a slight glimmer of hope last week before the Wednesday massacre. There were some mediation efforts being attempted, but once that massacre happened, I fear we've turned the corner, and it's very difficult to see the different sides sitting down and negotiating and understanding about how to move forward. And without including what still remains the largest political grouping in the country, the Muslim Brotherhood, in the political process, you can't have a real democracy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Egypt in crisis and what now for the country, the region, the United States. Shadi Hamid is with us from the Brookings Doha Center in Qatar, American of Egyptian descent. Mona El-Tahawi, Egyptian from Cairo, joins us, columnist, outspoken there internationally since the Tahrir Square days. Last week, it became as bloody as it gets. Last Wednesday, here's police firing live rounds on Muslim Brotherhood supporters in Cairo. Here's an interview with The Guardian last week. Ibrahim Mustafa, an optician in Cairo, saying he'd lost hope both in President Mohamed Morsi and the head of the armed forces, now looming so large, General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Here he says, I just want to say the Muslim Brotherhood started the country's divide and Sisi finished it. He's responsible for everything that's happening now because he is a dictator. And here, last week, from his vacation residence on Martha's Vineyard, President Obama.
America cannot determine the future of Egypt. That's a task for the Egyptian people. We don't take sides with any particular party or political figure. I know it's tempting inside of Egypt to blame the United States or the West or some other outside actor for what's gone wrong.
Jackson Deal of the Washington Post joins us in a moment on the American role here. But first, Shadi, Mona, about where this is and where this may be going. There have been speculation in the States saying this could turn into another Syria. Shadi, what do you think of that?
Well, you certainly hope not. I mean, holding out hope that cooler heads will prevail here. I think it turning into a full-on civil war like Syria is still somewhat unlikely, simply because the other side doesn't have the kind of arms to challenge Egypt's military, which, while it isn't great at combat with other countries and doesn't have a great record on that, it is very good at internal security and being very heavy-handed with its own people. So I think that's a very much a mismatch. That said, I think what we're more likely to see is low-level insurgency getting worse in Sinai, guerrilla warfare in different parts of Egypt, particularly outside the major cities, to see the normalization of political violence, So you'll end up seeing clashes between pro and anti Morsi supporters on a regular basis. So I think even the best case scenario is going to look pretty bad. But you do, you know, at the end of the day, you hope that it stays short of civil war. Of course, that, you know, that's not itself very reassuring.
Mona, you're in Cairo. Do you sense we've seen a lower death toll in recent days? Do you sense that the Muslim Brotherhood is backing off? Will they continue to after today their spiritual leader was arrested? That never happened under Mubarak, Mohammed Badi arrested. Or are we going to see, you know, more clashes in the streets? And for that matter, the kind of guerrilla activity that Shadi describes.
I think what the terrible events of the past week have reminded me of the most is back in the 1990s when I was a correspondent for Reuters News Agency here in Cairo, and we had a militant Islamist campaign against the Mubarak regime. Now, it wasn't the Muslim Brotherhood then, it was armed groups, because the Muslim Brotherhood back then was an Islamist group that had renounced violence. But we were seeing attacks on police officers. We were seeing assassination attempts against officials, including Mubarak himself. We saw attacks on the Christian community in Egypt and attacks on tourists. And I remember at the end of every week in the 90s, you know, I joined in 1993, and that militant campaign against the regime, you know, reached a horrendous climax with the attack on the Hatshepsut Temple in Luxor, in which more than 50 people died, tourists and Egyptians. And every week we would keep a death toll of, you know, all the people who died, police, Christians, tourists. It was horrible. And I really hope that we don't reach that in Egypt. And the difference now, of course, is that back then, Egyptians didn't have access to satellite television that would give them, you know, hour-to-hour, 24-hour coverage of, you know, a siege of a mosque or a sit-in that was, you know, very, very bloodily broken up. And they didn't have access, we didn't have social media so that you could follow this minute by minute. So I think that, or I hope rather, A, that scenario doesn't reoccur, and B, that as Egyptians watch this, they recognize that the military regime, the regime and the military together, and the Muslim Brotherhood understand each other's language, which is a language of violence and negotiating in blood, and that they had to resist mostly here, and this is what I hold the security forces and the regime military most responsible for, this climate of fear that has a state of emergency in 14 provinces and a curfew that begins at 7 p.m. You know, in a city like Cairo, which is one of the noisiest cities in the world, it's deadly quiet, unnervingly quiet at 7 p.m. So, you know, this idea that the state has created this atmosphere of fear and paranoia, and that people willingly give up freedoms for this illusion of security. In the United States, we know very well what that means.
Enforced calm. Shadi, yes, please. Yes.
Yeah, I don't think it's appropriate to kind of establish any moral equivalency here. The violence is not equal on both sides. Yes, there is a minority on the pro-Morsi side which has used violence and has taken up arms, but the vast majority have not done that. And we also have to distinguish between the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist groups. The ones who are responsible for the violence against churches and other attacks, there's no evidence that those are Muslim Brotherhood members. So we're talking about a diffuse opposition. Some of them are Brotherhood, some of them are Salafis, some of them are radical Islamists, so on and so forth. And that's what makes it very difficult to control, because it's not as if the Muslim Brotherhood has a switch where they say and tell everyone who supports Morsi, don't do this or do that. They're losing control over the rank and file, many of whom are angry, frustrated, and want revenge. And some of those people are going to take matters into their own hands. So if it was a matter of the Brotherhood imposing discipline on everyone who supports their cause, that would be one thing. But I think what we're going to start seeing more and more of is the splintering of different groups, and it's going to be very hard for any one party to coordinate.
A lot of violence, a lot of churches up in flames already. Shadi Hamid, Mona El-Tawi, please stand by. Let's get a couple of callers right here. Steve in Windham, Connecticut. Steve, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks so much for letting me have my say, Tom. You know, my thoughts are like limits to American power. You know, after a decade of sending our kids out onto the battlefield, I cannot believe that I read in some of these Egyptian papers that they think we're pulling their chain. I mean, and this guy, General al-Sisi,
yeah,
his murderous thugs, you know, I saw YouTube wave after wave of humans walking into rifle shots. I mean, this is outrageous. Outrageous.
And they were shooting at the upper body. They were shooting at the head.
Oh, it was completely disturbing. It was complete. And listen, the American Tea Party, to me, looks just like the Muslim Brotherhood. You know, they're just a bunch. They're wacky. These people need to express themselves.
Well,
they were losing in the polling.
But I don't think it's fair to call a group that's hung in there for so long against so much opposition from the government, you know, wacky. I mean, for decades they were oppressed, and yet they hung in there. They came. They won an election. Steve, let us pick it up. Mona, what do you think is likely to happen with the political direction of the Muslim Brotherhood? Are there some members there who would be open to coming back into a political process, or is that ripped? Is that torn now? Hello, Mona, are you there? Shadi, I'll go to you. What do you think?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's very difficult to persuade Brotherhood members to come back into the process if there aren't guarantees that there will be free and fair elections, or that, let's say hypothetically, the Brotherhood runs in a parliamentary election, they win a plurality, would they be allowed to appoint a prime minister? Would that be permitted by the army and the state? So those questions, you know, have not been answered, and there's nothing to suggest that the army is willing to let them play a major role in the country, even possibly governing again. I mean, that's, after all, why they had a coup against Mohamed Morsi in the first place, because they didn't want the Brotherhood in power. So I think there's a real risk that more and more Islamists will withdraw altogether from the political process and say, listen, we tried democracy, we gave it a shot, people wouldn't let us rule. Now we might try something else. That's the real fear here.
Because something else is, as you say, possibly armed conflict. Guerrilla, we've already seen it in the Sinai.
Yes, we're already seeing signs of this, and it could get much worse. I mean, the insurgency in Sinai, there was militant action before the coup, but it's gotten considerably worse in recent weeks. We're seeing very aggressive attacks against government and police installations. So there is already a trend line moving in that direction. And to add to that, as if that wasn't enough, was the revenge attacks, so-called, that you're seeing against Christians and churches. So that's extremely troubling. And what I really worry about is that Christians are going to be scapegoated by militant Islamists who are just going to go around seeking revenge.
Why are Christians and Christian churches targets? Why would they be seen as targets for revenge? For what?
Well, there's always been sectarian tension in Egypt, especially in the rural areas of the country. So clashes have happened on a regular basis. So it's, you know, oftentimes it's simmering underneath the surface, and then something sparks it. Now, unfortunately, many Islamists are under the impression that Christians are either part of the old regime or back General Sisi and see the church as complicit. And of course, you know, that's something we all, you know, all of us watching from the outside disagree with, but that is the perception that is taking hold among more and more Islamists. How you address that and how you try to lessen that sectarian tension, I worry that it's entering into a spiral that's very difficult to stop. And I think it's also worth pointing out that the government isn't doing nearly enough to secure the churches. The state ultimately has that responsibility, but they aren't doing that, which raises a lot of questions about whether the government is trying to use the attacks on churches to justify their narrative and to point and say, look at those crazy Islamists who are killing Christians.
We have to crack down. Let's go to Augusta, Georgia, and Mary Beth. Mary Beth, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I got married in Cairo in April. My husband's Egyptian.
Okay.
He is living in Cairo right now, and we're going through immigration. So that's my situation. I know he lives in Giza. He went down the street yesterday, ran into some Muslim Brotherhood, causing a fight in the street. He saw two people get killed last week in front of his home, Muslim Brotherhood trying to break into a police station. These people are armed, and the people are seeing the military as their protector right now. And, you know, that's really just my take on it. It's that these people had guns and, you know, they were protesting, but they were hunkered down with weapons. And now that they have cleared those protest places out, people are just out in the community. And as far as, you know, I know that the churches were burned down, and my husband and his friends have helped guard these churches. I mean, the Egyptians do not want violence, but they just see the Brotherhood as terrorists.
Mona, I want to get your response to that. Mary Beth, I appreciate your call from Augusta. Mona, there is the view, I guess, with Mary Beth's husband in Egypt, you know, of the Muslim, this is the military line. The Muslim Brotherhood are terrorists. Now, clearly, the Muslim Brotherhood is up in arms right now. They're very agitated. Is this the perspective of that part of Egyptian society that Shadi says is now supporting the military takeover?
You know, this morning, Tom, I was at morning Egypt time, that is. I was at my favorite coffee shop here in Cairo, and I met my favorite waiter. And 2 months ago, I hadn't seen him in 2 months. 2 months ago, we discussed the revolution and what Morsi has done to derail the revolution and protests and that campaign to get petitions to sign people to say we want early presidential elections. And I see him 2 months later, and his screensaver on his iPhone is General Sisi. And I was shocked and horrified, and we got into a huge argument about exactly that kind of thinking. Now, as I was saying earlier, I'm against both sides. I consider both the regime, military, and the Muslim Brotherhood to be fascists, and I think that Egypt deserves much better than them. But, you know, I turn on Egypt TV on the rare occasions that I do, and there is a huge campaign to dehumanize the Muslim Brotherhood. There is a huge campaign to make them somehow less Egyptian. Now, regardless of the fact that I don't like either side, and I think that we need a million more alternatives than these two binaries, at the end of the day, the Muslim Brotherhood are Egyptians. And at the end of the day, they must be included in whatever process we move forward ahead with. And we have to have some kind of process by which, if you commit a crime, if you are armed, you are arrested according to the rule of law, you are given basic human rights, you are not paraded like a trophy, like the guide of the Muslim Brotherhood was, you know, early hours of Egypt's morning when he was arrested. All of this must stop. We have to remember at the end of the day we're Egyptians. And the propaganda that is coming out from both sides is horrendous, and obviously taking into account that the state has many more means at its end, including security and the use of force. For the sake of Egypt, all sides have to sit down and talk and stop the violence.
What will the incentive be for the military to do that now that it is more or less in charge again? Why would it do that, Mona?
I am no friend to the military. We fought long and hard against military rule for decades in Egypt, Tom. And after Hosni Mubarak was forced to step down, we had a military junta, and every week it faced protests from people. The military understands that Egyptians have changed forever. The military understands that it was the revolution and those who supported the revolution that pushed it to determine a civilian handover to civilians. And the military understands that our ability to say no is louder these days than it has ever been in the past. The military also understands that the entire world is watching, and that when they do commit massacres, there are investigators on the ground that call it the single worst incident of mass killing in Egypt's modern history, as Human Rights Watch have. All of those things must be held against the military. And General Sisi has to understand that we will not allow a return to a military junta. We have an interim government backed by the military, yes, but if we do not move along those lines, and I don't trust them, I don't trust them 1 second, but if we don't move along this so-called roadmap that he's offered to Egypt, and he becomes the military dictator of Egypt, we will be out on the streets as we were against the military junta.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Egypt in crisis and what now for the country, the region, the United States, and its role. Mona Telhawi joins us from Cairo in Egypt. Shadi Hamid is with us from Doha, Qatar, the Brookings Doha Center there. Going to Jackson Deal at the Washington Post for the view of Washington's role so far. A couple pieces of tape on that front. On Fox News Sunday, Republican Representative Peter King, New York, spoke about the future of American aid to Egypt just this last weekend.
I'd be reluctant to be cutting off aid. Obviously, we should use it as a bargaining wedge. We should lean on the military to the extent we can. But I would not want to undercut them and allow the Muslim Brotherhood to come back, because they have shown they are not capable of democracy.
Kind of right back in the same old Mubarak embrace. On Face the Nation Sunday, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, told Bob Schieffer the U.S. must suspend aid to Egypt for the military to scale back, to scale back the violence.
We're going to have to suspend our aid because we can't support the reaction of the military. Even though the Brotherhood overplaying their hand started this, we can't support what the military is doing in response. I would tell the generals that we're going to suspend all aid until you allow a democratic transition.
And I want to go to Washington right now and Jackson Deal, deputy editorial page editor for the Washington Post. He has been a correspondent all over the world, was a bureau chief in correspondent in Jerusalem for the Post. Jackson Deal, welcome to On Point.
My pleasure, Tom.
You have been very critical in your columns in the Post of the Obama administration's handling of the situation, as if it could be handled by Washington. Maybe that's the wrong word. What's the basis of your criticism of the administration?
Well, I think they've been weak and indecisive, and I think Obama has clung to the standard American policy towards Egypt, which is to back the military regardless of what they do. The idea is to retain our influence in Egypt, but the perverse effect of that has been to cause us to lose all of the influence that we used to have. And this has been compounded by a kind of defeatism that's overtaken the administration and other people in Washington, this notion that there's nothing we can do now to stop the military from killing people in Cairo. And I think that's wrong. I think there's actually a lot the United States, especially in conjunction with its allies, could do to force the military to choose between its relationship with the United States and the West and the course they're currently pursuing.
The president hasn't really put it in those terms. He hasn't said, well, we're going to go back and support the military again. He's taken a kind of moral stance, but then not acted to intervene, but spoken of a kind of, you know, moral perspective on this.
He's spoken a little bit of a moral perspective. He's also spoken about larger American interests in the region, which is code for continuing to back the military. And as a practical matter, what he's done is try and split the difference. He's refused to actually break off decisively the relationship with the Egyptian military, but he's withheld some things. They didn't send some F-16s that were due to be delivered to Egypt this month.
Yep.
They're now saying they're going to not deliver some Apache helicopters, which were supposed to be delivered next month. And there have been some leaks in the last 24 hours that, as a practical matter, the administration has put a lot of the aid programs on hold not suspended them, but kind of put them on an unannounced hold for the time being while it tries to decide what to do. So what he's done is try and neither to send a message without really being decisive, and the result has been to sort of anger the Egyptian military without persuading them that their relationship with the United States is really at risk.
Well, look at what the U.S. should do, but what leverage does it really, really have, Jackson? I mean, we've read these reports of administration figures all over the telephones to Cairo before the bloody massacre last week. What was it, Chuck Hagel, defense secretary, something like 17 phone calls talking for an hour at a time to General Sisi there, and, you know, sort of bupkis as a result.
And here's the problem with that. The Egyptian generals had been convinced before those phone calls took place that regardless of whether or not they paid attention to what they were hearing over the telephone from Secretary Hagel, the United States would not break its relationship with them. And the reason they thought that is because before the coup, the White House specifically warned the Egyptian military that if you launch a coup, we're going to be forced to suspend aid because we have a law in the United States that says aid must be broken when there is a military coup. So the coup takes place, and then the administration announces publicly, well, we're not going to respect that law. We are not going to make a decision about whether a coup has taken place, and therefore we are not going to have to suspend aid. So the generals in Egypt see that the United States wasn't willing to follow up on its own very explicit threats before the coup. So therefore, why should they then listen to Secretary Hagel when he advises them not to break up the demonstrations? I think that's the problem we're having. We've lost credibility with the military. We have not yet put them in a place where they are forced to decide about whether they really want to maintain their relationship with the United States. If they were in that situation, we would have leverage.
Mona El-Tahawi in Cairo, do you see the United States, the Obama administration, as having, in effect, despite all those desperate phone calls, in effect have given a green light for the violence we saw last week from the military?
I think the U.S. administration is confused about Egypt, and its confusion has in turn confused everybody in Egypt to the extent that everybody is incredibly hostile to the U.S. right now because it thinks that the U.S. is biased towards the other camp. I think this is the consequence of decades of supporting a dictatorship at the expense of the people for the sake of stability. But I think we also have to be really honest here about especially military aid to the Egyptian army or the Egyptian military from the U.S. It's given for the Camp David Treaty to keep peace between Egypt and Israel, and also the $1.3 billion that are given to the Egyptian military from the U.S. every year goes right back into to the U.S. because Egypt then buys American-made weapons with that money. So those are the two issues that you have to put on the table when you talk about aid from the U.S. to Egypt, Israel and U.S.-made weapons. And I think that any ally of Egypt who does not speak out and say, stop the violence now, and any ally of Egypt that provides it with weapons that kills Egyptians, of course must have a huge stain on its conscience. As I've said repeatedly, I condemn unequivocally the mass killings by Egyptian security forces, and the U.S. and others who supply Egypt with weapons have to understand that those weapons they're giving the Egyptian military, for example, are being used to kill Egyptians because we're not at war with anyone right now.
Shadi Hamid, we'll look forward, but let's stay on what has just happened in the last couple of weeks here. Do you think that the U.S. could have changed the course of what we've seen unfold? Could American influence have pushed things in a different direction, Shadi? How? What?
Well, first of all, the U.S. should have worked much more aggressively before the coup even happened. There were signals that was being considered, particularly in the final weeks leading up to June 30th. The U.S. Could have been and should have been more involved in diplomatic efforts to prevent that outcome and to send a much more clear message, as Jackson pointed out, to the military that there would be consequences. The problem here is the military never believed America's threats were credible. They knew that no matter what U.S. officials said, they could probably get away with it. They tested the limits, and they were, in fact, correct. And the fact that we're not even willing, as Americans, to respect our own law on matters of national security is, first of all, not just bad policy, but it's also somewhat embarrassing.
Call a coup a coup, but we didn't do it.
Yes, and there's no one, who, at least outside of Egypt, who disagrees that this was a coup. It was actually a textbook coup. And at some point, you have to call things by what they are. And again, this is a problem that my fellow guests have pointed out. The U.S. totally lacks clarity on its Egypt policy. There's always this debate. What does Obama really want? What is he really saying? Even today, there's a debate on social media about whether the U.S. has suspended aid or it's putting it on pause or it's doing so secretly. We just don't know. And that sends a lot of mixed messages. It's time for clear messaging about what the minimal standards are for the Egyptian military to continue receiving aid.
A lot of criticism out there. James Traub wrote in Foreign Policy, headline on his essay, "Speak Softly and Carry No Stick." Jerome in Decatur, Illinois is calling. Jerome, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think that this administration, particularly our president, has already set us up as a weak man in the international community. From the beginning, all of his speeches about the United States pushing people around and how, you know, historically we've been, you know, the big bully. And so I think that, I mean, look at Moscow, look at the Middle East. No one's paying attention to this man. I think that we need to let the Middle East people come to the table themselves with the Saudis, who are going to give more money than the United States is giving for whatever purposes over there. We need to keep our guns, our planes, our helicopters out of the mix because we don't know who it's going to. And I think because of the sequester, looking at it from a national standpoint, we need to keep our money here at home, keep an eye on it. But I don't think this president wants to get involved anyway. I think he's already set the stage for it.
But, Jerome, I mean, you sound critical of President Obama, but you essentially articulate his policy. He's said a lot of things, but the bottom line is he hasn't wanted to get involved in it. Didn't want another Iraq, didn't want another Afghanistan, and it sounds like you don't either.
Well, I'm thinking that because we have allowed this thing to go so far, I think the only way it's going to is just like our own United States Civil War. I think it's going to be totally up to the people over there. I don't think the United States has enough muscle to do anything over there because we set ourselves up like that over the last eight years or so.
Jerome, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Jackson Deal, what about the U.S. situation now? What leverage it may have in Egypt in particular, the stakes for the U.S. there, and how the U.S. ought to act. What do you say, Jackson?
Well, I would pick up on one thing that Jerome just said and say we ought to let the other side, make the other side come to us on this. Our problem has been, as Shadi Hamid pointed out, that the Egyptian military doesn't believe that we will ever break our relationship with them. So the way to gain leverage over them is to break the relationship, to suspend the relationship, and to say, if you want to have a relationship with the West, if you want Western investment, if you want Western tourism, if you want Western weapons and military training, you need to come back to us and come back with a plan for a credible plan for democracy in Egypt.
So you're talking more than cutting off military aid. You're talking a boycott, cutting off investment, requiring U.S. companies to pull out, I don't know, financials. I mean, that's like we treat Iran.
No, I think what you start with is an aid suspension. Now, as a practical matter, there already is an investment break because there already is a tourism break. Tourists don't want to go to Egypt. There's a State Department warning against traveling to Egypt. In order to obtain foreign investment again, Egypt is going to have to make a deal with the International Monetary Fund because their finances are totally in disorder. And for that, they're also going to need United States support. I'm not suggesting a boycott, an economic boycott of Egypt. What I'm suggesting is that if Egypt wants to stabilize its economy, it's going to need the West and the United States. If Egypt wants to return to the place that it was, a growing economy that was integrating with the world, it needs the United States. It can't do it with Saudi Arabia. And that is our leverage. Our leverage is to say to them, if you want our help, if you want our help with the IMF, if you want our weapons, if you want Western tourists, you need to get back on the path to democracy.
Shadi, do you agree? I mean, we're hearing about Gulf states putting $12 billion or something forward. U.S. military aid is $1.5. Does the U.S. have that much leverage? Can the Egyptian military not go forward if President Obama were to cut that aid?
Yeah, Gulf countries can step in and offer $12 billion, but they can replace the military relationship that the U.S. has with Egypt in terms of provision of equipment, training, and the thickness of military-to-military relationships, which have been built over decades. And not only that, as Jackson pointed out, there is the IMF loan. There are our allies in Europe, and that's several billion dollars there. If you take it all together and also the certificate of good health that an IMF loan would offer, sending a message that it was safe to invest in Egypt, all of that adds up to a lot of money and perhaps even more than what the Gulf countries are willing to contribute. And what Saudi Arabia is offering is a stopgap measure. There are no structural reforms that they're requiring, obviously, right? And unless Egypt is actually willing to get serious about those reforms, its economic situation is going to be unsustainable. So the Gulf can do quite a bit in terms of what they can offer, but they can't replace the role of the U.S., Europe, international financial institutions.
So if the U.S. and Europe put the pressure on, what should maybe cut aid more? What should they ask in return for restoration then of that support?
Well, first of all, don't kill your own citizens in the street. And again, we're talking about, according to Human Rights Watch, the single worst massacre in modern Egyptian history. So as a general rule of thumb, America should not be giving aid to countries that kill their own people in the street. That's the absolute minimum. But beyond that, we have to talk about an inclusive democratic process that allows a role for Islamist groups like the Brotherhood to come in and to have a stake in the political process. Now, I think we're in some ways beyond that. I think we should put that as a goal, but I worry that You know, as I said earlier, Egypt has turned the corner, and what we're seeing is the restoration of a brutal, of a brutal old regime. So that's why we can't keep on waiting. There's still perhaps a chance that we can get the military to think twice about what it's doing. But the longer we wait, the more entrenched the military is going to be in its own way of thinking. So, and this has always been the problem with the Obama administration. We wait, we wait, we wait, and then when we're finally ready to act, we don't have the kind of impact that we would have had if we had acted early.
Jackson, if I may, the stakes are clearly highest here for the Egyptian people. But look more broadly. The president of the United States talks about American interests. If the military becomes deeply re-entrenched, if we get an entrenched conflict again, maybe more violent than before with the Muslim Brotherhood, what are the stakes for the region? What are the stakes for the United States if this goes badly, Jackson?
Well, it could be a disaster for the region, partly because of the role of Islamism in the region will be challenged in a very fundamental way. You know, if the Arab world is going to become democratic, they need to find a way to integrate Islamic points of view into politics peacefully. If this Egyptian course proceeds and you have a new autocracy, you're going to have Islamists not just in Egypt but around the region concluding that they have no place in democratic politics. And that could be a disaster for the democratic prospects for the region. It could lead to conflict around the region between Islamists and autocratic governments again.
Mona El-Tahawi, you're in Cairo. You are Egyptian today. Where's the hope here, Mona? Where's your hope?
My hope is that we end this killing, Tom, and that we sit down and we recognize, as I said, we're all Egyptian and we all have a right to being a part of this political process. And we have some kind, we put into place mechanisms that allow for things like peaceful transfer of power. We recognize that all these allies that send us money for various reasons. I find it incredibly hypocritical that we're talking about the U.S. aid to Egypt and not talking about how the U.S. supports a whole host of dictatorships, including the Saudis, including the Qataris, including others. I mean, so you have consistency. There's hope in consistency. Don't pick and choose. There's also hope in recognizing that people can point to, I don't want this to happen, but you have to have consistent policy in the U.S. as well. Something like Guantanamo must be shut down if you then want to accuse Egyptians or any other country of imprisoning people without charge. I want consistency everywhere.
Mona, we've got it. I'm afraid we're up against the clock. 600 dead in a day is a long way from sitting down to talk, but we hope with you that it can happen. Mona El-Tahawi, thank you for being here. Shadi Hamid in Doha. Jackson Deal with The Washington Post. Thank you to you all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.